Hi, this is Stuttering John Melendez from the Howard Stern Show. And for some really stupid reason, you're listening to the
Insufferable Bastards.
Great name for a podcast, morons.
Warning, this is a regular movie. It contains adult themes and adult language. Also, spoiler alert, please listen at your own risk.
Perfect. Perfectly fine.
Insufferable Bastards.
Those of you that are into podcasts, like to listen to that kind of stuff.
Sir John from Pint of Comics. Our intro music is by Satanic Panic 81. My name, for the purposes of this broadcast, is Carlos Danger. Carlos the Fat Man. I'm thinking about changing my name to Carlos the Fat Man. Embrace my obesity since everybody points it out on YouTube. I love that we've carved out like a really small following on YouTube and it's all about insulting my appearance. Thanks, YouTube. But hey, welcome to Insufferable Bastards. And that's my co-host, Mr. Brian Spears. Hello, Brian.
Hello, hello.
So I'm getting some feedback on your end there, but I don't know. We'll just deal with it. So, okay, first things first. A week from tomorrow, we're recording this on September 10th. Tomorrow, September 11th, you'll never forget. God bless all the souls who perished in that tragedy. But September 18th is CT Horror Fest in Naugatuck, Connecticut. Brian and I will be there with a table, with some recording devices, and we'll be recording podcasts at CT Horror Fest. Go to cthorror.com for tickets and a guest list. They announced the panels this week. And they're going to have a Thing panel. It's a little mini Thing reunion. And they're going to have a Scream panel. So it's going to be a good time. And I'm really looking forward to it. And also, it's going to usher in the Halloween season, right? I'm excited for that. But we have some stuff. We're going to be giving, in addition to recording episodes, we're going to be giving away some like literature and some pins, some stickers.
We're also rebranding, or we're officially, you know, coming out like as a new, under new ownership, under new management.
We used to be the Mobile Horror Companion, and now we're Insufferable Bastards. And we have this awesome, look at that beautiful coffee cup. It says Insufferable Bastards is our awesome logo I paid like $60 for. And on the back, it's got this meme I pretty much stole from Reddit. They thought I drank too much. I thought they existed too much. So we have like, I don't know, 10 of these. And I thought, how do we give them away? Do we want to sell them? We don't want your money. But anybody who comes up to us during CT Horror Fest on September 18th in the Naugatuck Event Center in Naugatuck, Connecticut, and says to us, Baba Booey.
Baba Booey.
Baba Booey. Just one time you have to say, or you can say it multiple times. But if you say Baba Booey, you'll get one of these cups right here for free. While supplies last, so it's not going to be a ton. But I thought that's the fairest way to do it, right? Let's see who our real listeners out there. Because we want to meet you.
We probably have like one listener in Connecticut.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. I have no idea. I know we owe one to a Pint of Comics, formerly known Johnny Ganache, man, formerly known as Johnny Ganache. But yeah, so that's that. All right, so this episode. Excuse me, I'm tired. It's Friday. I'm old. I'm fat. I'm tired. It's been a long week. But about a week ago or so, the latest episode of Untold, this Netflix docuseries, they call it, was released. I mean, there's been a new one since. But the latest one's called Crimes and Penalties. And it tells the story of Jimmy Galante, his son, AJ, and the Danbury Trashers. Jimmy Galante owned a trash hauling company, a very big one in Danbury, Connecticut.
It actually was my delivery. So it worked. It was in my area.
They controlled all of Fairfield County in Connecticut, all of Westchester and Putnam County over in New York. Already profitable business. Galante himself lived in New Fairfield, Connecticut. And, you know, he was eventually indicted and convicted on multiple. He had the RICO suit was bought against him. It turned out the government alleges he was paying a mob tax to the Genovese crime family to control the routes, the sanitation routes and all those areas I just mentioned, so they could jack up prices and form an illegal monopoly and all that good stuff. And he also he bought and created the Danbury Trashers. They lasted two seasons. He put his 17-year-old son in charge as the president, and also cheated there. He avoided the salary cap in the league like greatly. Like, I think it was $275 was the most they could spend. He spent close to $1 million by paying people under the table and giving them no-show jobs and all that good stuff. So why are we talking about that? Because I was a reporter at the News Times of Danbury. If you've seen the documentary, pretty much every a little headline that flashes, you know, that documentary style, there's a ton of News Times reporters in there. And it's all my former colleagues. I was there at the exact time Danbury Trashers were birthed and then aborted because of an FBI investigation. So earlier in the week, I had a podcast for my day job, and I'm still a reporter, where I had my former boss, my former editor on, the former mayor of Danbury, the longest serving mayor in the city's history, who was there when Galante did all this crap, former court reporter and a former columnist who, like AJ the Kid, favored. It was the only guy he would talk to at times at the paper. And we just did this podcast where we reflected, reacted to the documentary, and swapped stories about covering the case back in the day. So that's the second part of this podcast. It's about 52 minutes long. If you're sick of me blabbing, just fast forward and watch that conversation. But the Trasher one, I've watched like 1.5 times.
Okay, me too.
You know, it was hard to sort of watch it the first time because, like, I'm like, oh my God, there's Wendy Carlson. Hey, oh, there's Brian Coons. Like, I saw all the people I worked with. And then I'm saying, hey, there's Ethan Fry, my guy I worked with for like almost a decade. There, his name flashes on the screen there.
You got me a gig in one of my drawings is in there because you got me like a cover, a portrait.
That's funny. Yeah, that's right. Being Big Daddy. Yeah, Brian drew a drawing of Jimmy Galante. It was on the front page of the News Times of Danbury at one of those packages they did. But yeah, so that was all wild. But then I went back and I was kind of angry at it when I first watched it because I'm like, well, they're just glorifying a con man, you know, two-bit criminal here, you know?
Yeah.
And I always thought, I was there when AJ the Kid was running the team. And I just thought that was a total farce at the time. I didn't think he was really running the team. And I remember I thought, all right, this is just, you know, I mean, what kind of mobster grows up in South Salem, New York, which is as rich as can be, and then is in New Fairfield and gives his, to me, it was more of a story about, you know, a father who was a cheat who spoiled his son. You know, it was like a spoiled brat and his dad.
I saw more of him as like a spoiled brat, a spoiled kid.
But I did, you know, then I kind of did that podcast with my former coworkers and I kind of had a different spin on it. And I was like, yeah, all right, I can see it. I shouldn't be so down on it. And the second time I sort of watched it, I didn't realize it's a comedy. Like it just, they play it all for laughs. And as someone who was like sort of, I was in the newsroom when that stuff was happening. I wasn't a key reporter on any of that stuff. I was sort of a peripheral player, peripheral, however you say that word. So, but at the time it was stressful. You know what I mean? You could feel the tension in the newsroom trying to figure out what's going on with the FBI. And oh my God, the FBI just did this. Oh, they released tapes.
That's like a legitimate, like huge story, especially in local news.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, the guy created a hockey team. They were, you know, they were kind of known for fighting. I mean, they played all that up in the documentary. I don't remember it being that violent at all. And, you know, the ice arena, it's almost like, is it an arena? We, you know, the CT Horror Fest is there. It's a tiny little thing.
It's a tiny place. Yeah.
But, this, you know, it, I guess, I mean, people seem to love it. But what's really bothering me is, okay, so Netflix, in their preview for it, they're like, oh, he was the guy that inspired Tony Soprano. Yeah. And I've sort of become obsessed with that because, look, I worked for the News Times at Danbury, the paper that covered Jimmy Galante extensively. Like, there'd be no documentary if it wasn't for the reporters and the editors of the News Times who were covering him nonstop and, you know, cover the Trashers nonstop. Not just illegally, but I mean, that, you know, they were a beat to cover. So somewhere along the line, and like the Sopranos was already well into, I mean, by the time this all ended, the Sopranos was wrapping up, right? The Sopranos had begun years before the Trashers came about. I can guarantee you that somebody, at least at the News Times or somewhere, would have reported on the fact that, oh yeah, Tony Soprano, that this guy was the inspiration for him. It's so not true.
It's so
it annoys
true.
me. But I get it. It tells a good story, right? It's a good marketing tool for Netflix. What really bothers me is to see, like, you know, yeah, the News Times was a small paper, you know, a very small circulation. But like, if you watch the rest of this podcast, they took their job seriously. So now what it's become these 20 years later, if you look on YouTube right now, it's like some guy with a million views on his YouTube page, mobster son, AJ talks, Jimmy Galante, mobster, inspiration for Sopranos talks. No one's doing the least bit of fact checking to say like, well, wait a second, had David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, did he ever say Jimmy Galante was the inspiration for Tony Soprano? No, like that doesn't exist anywhere. Maybe I'm wrong. So
and listen, it would be more, I would know that. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I'm into that. I've been to where the Trashers hung out. I know, like.
Oh, we should tell that story. Let's come.
You know,
back to
like
that.
I've been. We were there when they were happening. You know what I mean? Like, sort of that.
It would have been everybody
WWE
would have known.
WWE thing they brought into that. We were hanging out in Danbury at that time, going out a little bit, checking out the town.
Yeah. I bring that up on this pod. Yeah, I was a card-carrying member of the Polish American Club. They had like $3 beers, you know. But like, well, it bothers me because it also like cheapens The Sopranos to me, because that's one of the greatest shows in the history of television. You know, some of the greatest writing that's ever been on television or anywhere for that matter. And to see its legacy, because now I'm telling you right now, from this point on, Jimmy Galante, you know, was the motivation for it's become. It's become fact. That's the way. Yeah. That's the way the media and social media.
Okay.
It really, and that bothers me because it's just not true. But and where it comes from at the beginning of the documentary, I have a clip we'll play. It's the, you know, the brawler, the goon guy, just says it offhandedly.
Yeah.
Here it is.
I've heard rumors that they based the Sopranos series off of this family. She had Italians, a trash hauling business.
We're going to FBI.
She had AJ and AJ, all the guys that hung around Jimmy. It's pretty much spot on.
I mean, the guy's reasoning is that they both have a kid named AJ. Hey, they're Italian and it's a trash hauling business. I mean, that's your proof. That's what everybody's going off. And the fact that in the documentary, they show a autographed picture supposedly from James Gandolfini to Jimmy Galante that says to the real Tony Soprano. But
yeah,
okay,
you know what?
Now here's one
you
thing,
say
Jimmy Galante.
What you want them to say, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, and like Jimmy Galante, I mean, maybe that's true. Maybe that thing is. I have no evidence to the contrary. But the guy got convicted in a RICO lawsuit, not known for his honesty, ladies and gentlemen. And then also what I looked at was David Chase was on that really good Sopranos podcast. That what's his name? Vincent.
The two dudes do.
Yeah, it's a good podcast. They don't talk directly, but they ask him about the origin of the Sopranos or of Tony Soprano specifically, but here's a clip of that.
Complete nonsense, or is there something to that?
Oh, what this is I guess at one point Lorraine Bracco had said that the therapist in the show, her character, is actually David Chase. That was her interpretation of it.
Okay.
So he's asking, is that complete nonsense?
Steve
complete
Shurrupa,
nonsense,
right?
Or is this?
Yeah.
No, it's not nonsense. But I mean, they tell you, and I don't know, in school or whatever, writing book, that all the if you write characters, they're all you. You know. So am I Tony? There's a lot of a lot of that is me. I feel that. Melfi, no, what? Melfi was based on the therapist that I went to.
So, I was reading a lot about the creation of The Sopranos. I mean, you know, David Chase first had the concept when he was writing for the Rockford Files.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Back in the day. And originally they told him, well, we want a Godfather show. We want to make it to a series. And he was in therapy himself. He's kind of an interesting tortured artist type. He had a really overbearing mother. He's from New Jersey. And so that's all from his life, not James Galante, who, by the way, was never alleged to be a member of the mafia,
I was going to also say that, like, he was not,
right?
like that was the thing. He wasn't a mob. Like he
he paid a tax. Yeah, he was definitely associated according to that, but he was never accused directly of saying, "Oh, you're a member of the mob." Maddie the Horse Genovese was. That's all. That's all very true. But you know, the other thing is Chase gave an interview, the Post, actually the New York Post. I mean, back in the day, New York Post is kind of. I mean, tabloids, New York tabloids are hanging on by a thread. They are what they are. Now they become like partisan, whatever, because that's what sells. But, you know, like when you and I were growing up, Post and the Daily News had mob reporters. Yeah. They had guys, that was their entire beat, which, I mean, you imagine how fantastic that must have been when, like, that was, you know, when newspapers were huge. So they were authorities and they published the story in about 2007 where they went through the actual inspiration for Tony Soprano was this mob guy in New Jersey, where Chase grew up, and they pointed to a 2002 magazine article, an interview that Chase did with this small magazine, talking about, oh yeah, well my, you know, this guy was in there, and it was this, you know, my cousin was involved in it, blah blah blah, and the Post is like, well, he's talking about such and such mobster, so like it's right there in black and white, not Jimmy Galante, and I say all that just to. It's just been sort of weighing on me. Then one other thing, here's one more clip from that podcast where they talk about the origins of the Sopranos.
David, did you grow up? I mean, did you grow up around mobsters? Did you know that world? I mean, did you have relatives or did you just know it just from knowing it?
I did have one cousin. Who was involved? This guy Joe Poupette. He was connected.
I love how careful he is to this day.
Boyardo family.
That's the that family. He's Boyardo family.
And my, you know, all people used to say, "Oh, him and his Cadillacs." And he got, I don't know, the cops came for him at 3 o'clock in the afternoon one time, just as his kids were getting off of school.
So that's the whole thing. I just wanted to say, like, there's no way in hell, unless I'm wrong, that Jimmy Galante inspired the Tony Soprano character. So that's that. And in the podcast that I do later, like, the mayor of Danbury brings up a couple little things that Doc got wrong. We talk about that a little bit. But I don't know, Brian, did we talk about, like, what you thought about it? Did you have any questions for me about it or whatever?
Well, I guess you sort of answered in the sense that, my thing was, all right, I did not like at the very end of this where they, like, all go out and it's Trashers Day. And fine, they're all celebrating being happy. Because, I mean, it was like, it kind of destroyed Danbury for a little bit. I mean, did he? I don't know. Like,
well, I asked Mayor Boughton about that in this, excuse me, Cassie. But, because that's sort of my take, too. I agree with you. Because you remember, we were there. They were always trying to get that downtown. Danbury has a very, like, unique downtown, right? They opened up a mall, and that kind of killed their downtown. And at the time there, in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, they were doing all these things to try to get some type of nightlife going in Danbury. And the Trashers were a hit. Yeah. They definitely had a buzz. They were the scrappy, dopey minor league team. You know what I mean? It was an exciting for Danbury. And that's what I asked about. And I was like, do you have any resentment that you have this thing going? And this guy, because he's so dishonest, he has to cheat. And the whole thing implodes. And it's federal indictments. And then of which, you know, there's always a rumor mill. There was like people whispering that the city gave him a deal with the stadium or the arena and all that. And Boughton addresses that, the mayor, former mayor. So, I do kind of agree with you there. It's sort of annoying that the documentary goes out of its way, you know, they overplay his role. They insinuate that he's a hardcore killer mobster. And
my issue with it is there's a lot of Galante in this. And, you know, in the 90s, he has a white beard like me, but now he's all like, you know, probably got a few plugs and there's new, like, you know, the Just for Men hairdo and this beard and everything. Like, I mean, listen, dude, just let it go. Like, look at me. It's like,
yeah, no, we always had, yeah.
It's so it's very vain and he's very talkative. Like, he's a Hollywood mobster. You know what I mean? Like, he's not a real,
He's not a street guy. I mean, I'll probably end up now, you know, with a horse in my bed. But I spent an hour with him, I didn't really get into this too much in the podcast you'll hear. But I was doing a story. I'm sorry, I interrupted you though. Is there something you wanted to end with?
Well, I don't really trust what he's saying because he's saying it. You know what I mean? Like, wanted to hear more about someone. Like, they would interview an FBI guy, or they, I wanted to see more of that aspect of it. In the sense, like, of course he's going to say whatever we want it to say. And he's had years and years to figure out his storyline.
They're so, and I can, what kind of bothered me too was the I think it was called the UHL, their president there, who was like, that guy was so full of shit. I mean, you know, I just thought he came across as like mealy mouth and weak because he's like, well, you're not going to embarrass this league there, AJ Galante. No way. And now they're like best, you know, best that guy like, he came across as a clown. So did the equipment manager with the cigar and the bald. Like, it looked like at a central.
Cocaine. I knocked down a kid. I used all the cocaine.
Yeah, I like to beat up kids high on cocaine. I'm a cool, right? And now we celebrate that. You know, that guy will probably be on the town council another year or two.
Like, I
thought that guy was awful. Just awful.
I'm going to listen more because I think what you guys are going to talk about in a few minutes is. It's kind of the stuff that I want to know. Like, it's more of a hard-hitting news story, and this was sort of a fluff piece.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. It was enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think
I have a lot of questions about the kid because, you know, I think he comes off kind of as, you know, I mean, again, he's a 17-year-old kid with a company, you know, and he likes the WWE. I was just like, oh, my God, this is killing me. Like, I don't, you know.
Yeah, and like I kind of thought, like, why would you, as a father, why would you do that to your son? What kind of, like, why would you trust that upon your...
But I mean, that's the father he is, though. That says a lot right there.
And that's what I thought. Maybe, and that's probably a harsh personal critique, but that's what I reacted to. And, you know, I felt bad for the kid because, you know, that was happening. You know, I had to do, I don't remember what the story was. At some point, I had to do a story, and I think he wanted to meet in person, from what I remember. I had to go over there. I think I might have been helping out another reporter. I think it was after the FBI raided the place.
Okay.
Although maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway, he was like, you know, I remember it was a dark room. You know, so I went to AWD over there on White Street.
White Street, yep.
And, he, you know, it was a big sort of gaudy office. And like the lights were bizarrely low, even like darker than it is here. And I remember there was like somebody kind of sitting behind me a little bit, which is like, I don't know. Sometimes like police would do that to you too. Like they'd sit down on, but I just remember he was, came across as, you know, I had worked at the video store where we grew up, and the owner of the video store didn't have a care in the world. He was like a big talker. You know, he had the slick back dyed hair. He was very similar to Galante to me. And that guy was a literal con man. He got sent to federal prison for scamming money out of Philip Morris. So like, to me, Galante had that vibe about him. Yes. He didn't strike me as like a street guy or a scary guy.
If there was any threat, he was a mob guy, I would never have drawn that picture. I would have been
right, out, yeah. You know? Yeah, I had that. I still have, I mean, I don't know. Actually, I might have given that to Ethan. Because I had that picture up until
I still have it.
Oh, you got one? Okay, so I must have a copy.
I'm a freak, two or three years ago. I have everything. I just got today in the mail, In the Heights, because it came out on DVD. Nice.
So I had my 1 hour with him, and I just remember the thing that he was talking about the most. There's a part of the documentary where he's like, you know, people or the paper was giving me trouble because there was too much violence in my games. I didn't care what they thought. I can tell you that is, he was obsessed with news coverage. Like, he liked talking to a reporter. He clearly liked the attention.
He likes the attention.
You know, he loved it. He likes to come across like he's, but he loved it, and he would send, like, we had an editorial writer at the News Times. Her name was Mary Connolly, right? And she had been there for a very long time. She had tons of institutional knowledge. She knew everybody and she knew everything. And she was not afraid to like call out a public official on his or her BS. And she wrote some pointed articles about Galante. I don't remember the exact context, but they riled him, but he loved the attention. So he'd send her flowers. So he made kind of a you know, a joke of it. And he was asking, did she get the flowers? And what'd she say? Like he was like a little kid on Christmas a little bit.
It's like this, man. I think it's like kind of where Danbury, where we live, New Fairfield, where, especially where I live, there's a lot of people I know, and I'm not like that are similar to a Galante type. Like they probably know a tough guy. Because around here, even where I live, man, there's guys that, like, you know, everyone, you know, they're bravado. They act like they watched The Sopranos.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, if you notice something about The Sopranos, all right, the way that was Tony. It's now everyone acts like Tony. Right. Tony wasn't acting like Tony. That was who he was.
Like, right. And even AJ, the son, now he's like in his 30s. He was born and raised in New Fairfield. Nobody in New Fairfield has whatever that Bronx accent. Like, I don't even know where that comes from. But yeah that is. It's not really like life imitating art here. It's more like life imitating art.
Yeah,
that was my impression too. If anything, The Sopranos influenced him.
That's my point. That's what I think they missed. This is a guy that, and he likes that. Because you could see in that interview, you know, it's all staged. It's, you know, it's very well shot in a sense. You know, he's got his, you know, I'm sure that was art direction there. But just, he agreed to do this. And again,
he's got to be loving it.
I said, please watch this documentary. It's fun and it's good. It's just the ending really irks me in the sense that he's like the superhero. And I think, like, if that Danbury team lasted, what that would have done to that downtown, like, that's the thing. Like, to me,
I agree with you.
Something out of Danbury.
I agree with you 100%. I think, I think that could have been a lasting thing.
I almost got beat up by a trasher.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that. Because you know what's weird about all this, Brian? Because it's like, you know, I've been a reporter for more than 20 years now, a local news reporter. And you can see it if you watch the next part of this documentary. Like the mayor asked the court reporter at one time, like, what do you remember most about this case or something like that? And she doesn't have an answer because you write so much, all the stories blend in. And this was a weird story to cover because it wasn't like there was a big trial. It wasn't like the FBI let the reporters in when they raided Galante's place on White Street. It was all through press releases and court filings. So there, you know, there was nothing memorable about it, really. You know, they're just little things that stuck out. So as I was getting ready to do the interview, I started to think about, didn't I message you? I was like, wait a second, didn't we run into them somewhere? We ran, and it turned out I wasn't imagining it. It was like a repressed memory of mine. So we were in a bar, right?
It was like a club.
Wait,
where the parking, right where the trashers would play, like the signs were everywhere.
It was the place with the mechanical bull.
Yeah, maybe they didn't have it on. It might have not been with a mechanical bull. They changed it. It might have been before that.
It wasn't the country bar? I don't think there's been anything there.
It was alternative music was playing. There might even have been a band in one section.
Right, it was Premier Music Hall. I think it was called, but I think there was still a mechanical bar there. But anyway, all right. So what happened?
Do you
remember?
Yeah, I totally remember. I was just being a jerk to these guys because they were good looking women.
So you went over, moseyed on over and started like challenging their sexuality or something like
that.
Yes. Did we know they were trashers?
No, you were, dude, what the hell are you doing? Those are trashers. Those are hot. They're going to get your butt. And I don't think you put it that, you know, as nice as I just did. Like, it was like, and I just was like, what are they going to do? Like, and they got really mad at me. And like, they left and the girl, like, I wasn't going to get the girl either. I didn't like go home with the girl. I was just being a jerk.
You were just the spoiler. You were the goon.
You guys could just walk in and they were like hockey players. You know what I mean? I was like, come on, guys.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that was the only time
let's play a game. Let's play a game. And I don't know anything about hockey. I'm just be like, you guys want to talk about Slapshot? I just kept playing Slapshot.
All right. So that's it for me and Brian on this episode of Insufferable Bastards. But now you've got 52 minutes of not really me. I tried to keep my mouth shut as much as I could. and try to just sort of move the conversation along. But it's a former court reporter who covered the Galante case, an editor who was in charge of coverage of the Galante case, the former mayor of Danbury, who was the mayor at the time in the Galante case and the Trashers. And who's the other guy? Oh, yeah, Brian Coons, who was a former sports reporter, sports columnist, covered UConn. He was a UConn beat reporter. So he's got a whole interesting background, and then was an editor and reporter in his own right. And actually, I'm the only guy that's still somehow in old school traditional journalism. In
traditional newspaper? Wow.
Yeah, everyone else has sort of branched out into other stuff, but I'm still stuck. That's why I do this, so I don't jump off a bridge. But all right. Is that it?
That's it.
See you next time. Wait, now I got to go find the stupid thing. Oh, wait, no. Here is one clip where AJ was on a podcast recently talking about what his father's up to today. Let's end with this.
Oh, you probably have to go, and I can't thank you enough for your time. What is your dad up to now? They didn't really dive into that, I don't think, at the end of the doc. Is your dad still running the yard, or what's he got going on?
My dad is going to be 69 this coming January, and he wakes up 4 a.m., and he's on a heating oil truck every day. He carries the hose. He fills up people's houses every day. He's an oil truck driver. That's what he's doing. And I'm like, Dad, you got to take a rest. You know, I mean, I understand it's, you know, but he's never going to stop.
That's that. Everybody, I'm Eugene Driscoll. Welcome to Naval Gazing, the Valley Indie podcast. I work for the Valley Independent Sentinel. It's valleyindie.org, covering Connecticut's lower Naugatuck Valley. So, all right, let's just get right to it, because these are busy people. They have lives. They have things to do. They don't have time to sit here and converse with me for too long. But Untold, Crimes and Penalties was released to Netflix about a week ago. Untold is a new sports docuseries, sort of Netflix answer to ESPN's popular 30 by 30 documentary series. And as I'm reading this, I forgot, I just got reading glasses, so I should probably put them on. Each episode, forget it, focuses on a single issue, and Crimes and Penalties tells the inside story of the Danbury Trashers, a minor league hockey team launched by Danbury trash hauler Jimmy Galante, of New Fairfield, by the way, before it imploded in federal indictments, mob connections, and deeply unfair business practices. Galante made his 17-year-old son, AJ, the team's president, by the way. And here are 30 seconds from the preview for this documentary. And spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, turn this off right now, go watch it, and then come back. But here's the preview, 30 seconds.
A gentleman by the name of Jimmy Galante bought his 17-year-old son his own hockey team.
I'm the president of the Danbury Trashers, and I'm 17 years old.
This was the largest investigation I've ever been a part of.
Jimmy was the real Tony Soprano.
We were the bad boys of hockey. A freak mix of pro wrestling and the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, that's probably the best line of the documentary where AJ describes what the Trashers were, and I'd say it's accurate, the combination of the Mighty Ducks and WWE. One thing I'll say right off the bat, I'm just going to throw my own opinion out there, and that this podcast is fact and some opinion. I don't think there's any record anywhere of David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, or anybody involved with The Sopranos, or anybody who wrote for The Sopranos, including like Richard Price and all these famous writers, that ties Jimmy Galante to the character of Tony Soprano. It's the only thing I'll say right off the bat. And if you have access to Google and you have fingers and ears, you could look that up yourself. But
no, I remember thinking the same thing when I was watching the documentary, because I remember also watching The Sopranos. And I think that's why a lot of people are intrigued by this case. And I remember it may have been based on another family.
Yeah, there it definitely was. It definitely, I have the recordings, and I can even share all that later. But that was Karen Alley, by the way. Let me go around and introduce everybody, because I'm very nervous, and I'm very proud to have each member of the panel here tonight. What I've gathered is a bunch of people who were reporters and journalists and editors working for the News Times of Danbury, Connecticut, where the Trashers were based, the newspaper that provided extensive coverage of Jimmy Galante before, during, and after the whole Danbury Trashers thing. I also have a former mayor to introduce in a second. These journalists will be responding to the doc and sharing memories, if they have any, of different aspects of the Galante case. So let's go around in alphabetical order. First, we have, you just heard her speak. She is the News Times former court reporter. She was an editor with the paper. She won a public occurrence award at the News Times. Was that at the News Times, Karen? You won
that? Yeah. That was fun.
What was that for?
Yeah, that was for Galante.
Oh, it was for this. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, the whole team won it. But, okay. Yeah, I was like the lead reporter.
And you're currently a strategic communications manager with Michael J. London and Associates. Is that correct?
Actually, I just moved on to Quinn and Harry.
There you go. Okay, forget all that. This is where my editing will come into play. But in any case, welcome to the show, Karen Ali. My next guest.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. I'll go in an alphabetical order. The next guest was the longest serving mayor of Danbury, Connecticut. He stepped down in December 2020 to serve as Connecticut's commissioner of the Department of Revenue Services, which doesn't sound quite as exciting. But welcome to the program, former mayor of Danbury, Mark Boughton, everybody.
Thanks, Eugene. I hope I don't risk my job by being on here tonight, but I couldn't resist. And those were certainly exciting times. I do miss everybody on the screen, because even if you're being covered, you know, by a reporter or an editor, you know, I always understood what the border was, you know, what the barrier was, but you do develop friendships and affinity for each other. And as I always say to young politicians that approach me about what we do, I said, don't worry, there'll be another story tomorrow. So be nice, be kind, and be transparent, and you'll always get treated fairly. You may not like what they write, but you'll be treated fairly. So it's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mayor Boughton. Next is another former ink-stained wretch. During his years at the News Times, he covered UConn basketball. He was an award-winning columnist. He was a sports columnist. He was sort of a slice-of-life columnist at one point. In addition to being a reporter and an editor in his own right, the man did it all. Please welcome Mr. Brian Coombs.
Thank you, Gene. Pleasure to be here with such a distinguished panel, and I'm looking forward to our conversation tonight.
Me too. And Brian's got to go early, so we got to do this quickly. Next guest is actually a Seymour resident, so I do have one local connection to the Lower Naugatuck Valley, the area I cover for the valleyindy.org. He was the hard-charging managing editor of the News Times when the FBI first raided Jimmy Galante's AWD trash business on White Street in Danbury. Ladies and gentlemen, my former boss, the greatest editor I ever worked with, Mr. Paul Sussman.
I'm blushing. Thank you. It's great to see all my former colleagues and former acquaintance and good acquaintance in Mark Boughton again.
Yeah. So, all right, let's get started. So I worked at the News Times from 2003 to roughly 2009. I did two tours at the News Times at Danbury. And at one point, I spent like an hour with Jimmy Galante. I don't remember even what the story was. I don't think I even got a story out of it. I just remember he couldn't stop talking about Mary Connolly, our editorial writer. And he had sent her flowers. He was just obsessed with Mary Connolly. But that's neither here nor there. Let's start with Brian Coombs, because he has to go to work, literally, as I said earlier. Brian, now maybe I imagined this, because, you know, my memory's not so good. But I sort of remember when all this was going on, at some point, AJ Galante, the son, would only go through you. I remember one time being in the newsroom, we were working on some story, and the only person in the newsroom he would talk to was you. I even remember I think he called on the overhead phone. We were on deadline for some story about Galante. I don't know where it was in the timeline, but a hush came over the newsroom because he wanted to talk to you and you alone. So everyone just sat there and listened. As you were talking to this kid. And did I make that up? Maybe I was drinking. What was going on?
No, and I think it really, it played out the way that Mark was talking about a little bit before, that he was the president of the Trashers, as, you know, perhaps as absurd as it might be, 17 years old. But I spoke with him as he were as if he were the president, which he was. And that I think that I treated him fairly. I think that he thought that I treated him fairly. I think that his dad thought that I treated him fairly. And like Mark said, that he may not have liked everything that I wrote, but I would get, you know, his side of the story, or if I had a question or I needed a detail, would reach out to him and give him a fair shake. But I think
was it a thing where he would, am I wrong though? Because I remember him specifically asking, like, you were the only person he would talk to at one point. Is that correct, or am I wrong?
No, that is correct. I think that he felt, and, you know, I'm not sure where that originated from, you know, perhaps from his dad and such too, that didn't trust anyone in the media. And from going from the early days to his initial press conference, I didn't cover them as a beat. Rich Gregory, that, you know, folks here may remember, covered the Trashers as a beat. As you mentioned earlier, I was covering UConn at that time, but I would come in and do some spot duty. Actually, the second year when they ended up playing the team from Kalamazoo for the championship, went out to Kalamazoo and had a chance to, you know, just sit and not necessarily for a story, but shoot the breeze with AJ a little bit and, you know, what's going on, how are things going? So I think there was a rapport there that I wasn't out to necessarily bury them, but I wasn't out to either, you know, glorify the Trashers or the AJ or the Galante family either. My objective was to get the story. And he, in fact, you know, he was my best source.
He was just a kid though. I mean, you look back, there's that scene in the documentary.
Oh, sure.
Where he's at a press conference and the kid's 17 years old and he acts like a 17 year old kid and it just kind of thrust into the spotlight. And I guess one of the things I'll say nice about the documentary is that I like it's sort of AJ's story. Jimmy Galante is still an enigma, I think, to a lot of us. And you don't really have any idea of who he is as a man by the end of this. But so what was AJ like? Did he seem like he was in over his head? Because the documentary makes it seem like, well, actually, he's the guy that put the team together in terms of positives for the Trashers. He's the kid that did it. Was he scared? Was he nervous? What was he like to talk to?
I think he was initially. I do. I think that he was nervous and scared. But I think on the, you know, the other side of that coin, I think that he was energized and excited. And like you heard him there, that holy cow, we're going to have a cross between, you know, professional wrestling and the Mighty Ducks. And as you see from game one, puck drops and the gloves drop and let's go. I mean, there was no illusions here about what this team was going to be. It was going to be a fight first, play hockey second type of team. That said, I think that was the whole marketing shtick. Fans from Greater Danbury responded to that. And I think as more fans filled the arena, as all of a sudden now, you know, it wasn't just the News Times and WLAD. You had media from Hartford coming, media from ESPN coming, media from New York coming. I think that you could see him growing into this role, becoming more confident. But again, I think that, and it's always the way I've tried to conduct myself,
you're
covering UConn with Jim Calhoun,
not like me.
No, with Jim Calhoun, the same. And Jim Calhoun hated my guts. As Mark had mentioned, Mark had always been a straight shooter with me. I'm sure there were times when I was a take on life columnist. He didn't necessarily like some of the things that I wrote, but you try to maintain that professional, you know, relationship with people and don't burn bridges. It's not always, you're not always going to be liked, but your job is to report the story, you know, as best and as fairly and as accurately as you can.
All right. Since you got to go, what was your impression of this documentary? And I'm also going to ask you how many hockey sticks would you give it out of five? I just made that up. I don't know. What'd you say?
So what I thought was really interesting here was, you know, I think that you would use the word ambiguity early on, that this documentary makes it very clear that, you know, certainly the fighting, the bad boys of hockey, that whole image, yes, that put, you know, fans in the seats, Section 102, the whole nine yards. But it's not that the fighting isn't the reason that they won. The reason that they won is because they cheated, right? You look at the doing the jobs, and they mentioned not just the no-show AWD, DWD, all these, you know, the alphabet soup trash companies being able to do these no-show jobs, not just for players. And, you know, you had former Trashers confirming that in the documentary, their wives as well. You know, you looked at, I remember with the indictment, I went back and did a little bit of research on stories that, you know, I wrote and Karen wrote and other folks wrote, that the salary cap for the United Hockey League at that time was $250,000. And the feds estimated that the Trashers were somewhere like three times that, somewhere around $750,000.
And they still didn't win a championship.
And they still didn't win a championship. But the point is that, you know, you talked about AJ, that, you know, Jim Galante was ready to, you know, open the purse strings, write the checks, bring them in. But, you know, if we're going to go and we're going to pay you three times than what you would get from other, some other team, we're going to give you some no-show jobs and some of those other things. Yeah, you know what? Okay. You know, I don't care about scoring goals or assists or being a great defender or a great goal, whatever you want me to do, Mr. Galante. And that's really what it came down to. And I think that you see that, and that's really, you know, it's why they won, why they were able to command, I think, the attention and this whole mystique that they had. It wasn't because they were necessarily the best hockey players. They were some of the best fighters, and that, you know, it was almost like, okay, the bad boys of hockey. And then, you know, every other team had bounties on their heads.
It's interesting. And I'm going to throw it to Mayor Bouton in a second, but I thought there's so much talk in this documentary from Galante himself, Jimmy Galante himself. We hear loyalty come up again and again, loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. But I kept thinking, well, what about integrity? You know, and let me ask you, Mayor Bouton, and Brian, if you got to dip out, go ahead and do so whenever you want, but you're also welcome to stick around. But like, I look back and like, I was a person who was in downtown Danbury an awful lot in the Trasher days. You know, I started at the News Times 2003. I don't remember how old I was. I think I was in my, maybe I was 30 at most. I don't know how to add. But, you know, I was a member of the Polish American Club right there, card carrying member. You know, I'd go to Two Steps. I was a regular at Cousin Larry's up the road there. I remember, you know, I was just texting one of my friends. We got into sort of a verbal altercation with Trasher players at that country bar that was in Danbury for 5 minutes. Luckily, they didn't beat the heck out of us. I had a mechanical bull, which I proudly broke by accident because of my heft. But so you had this great thing in a way happening in that particular block of Danbury at that particular time, where the city was really trying to push people to go downtown. And he was putting butts in seats. And there was something about the mystique that fit Danbury and just fit hockey at that particular time. And then in 2 years, well, the guy was a massive cheat. Team is shut down. He's in jail. And that's it. Do you carry any resentment? And I might be projecting, Mayor Bouton. But is there any resentment when you look back about what unfolded in just those 2 years with the Danbury Trashers?
I don't know if I carry resentment. Certainly it was. Look, you know, when you have, and I think Karen can probably speak this really well as Sussman too. When you have that big, that massive of an investigation with that many agents working on it, with that many resources dedicated towards investigating one organization, it's unnerving, you know, in a sense. You hear things. This is right when the investigation was going on. When Jim decided to do the team, I said this publicly, and interestingly enough, I was interviewed for that documentary. I spent 3 hours with those guys that did the documentary. It all fell on the floor, but that's okay. I think that's probably a good thing when it's all done. But, you know, when Jim first said he wanted to do this team, I had heard the rumors, but I didn't have anything concrete to point to. I couldn't say you did this. No way. Yes, he had a tax indictment and that he had served his time. We're the second chance society, you know, and we are so desperate for a win downtown to get something going there that, as you mentioned, would put seats in, and it did, it worked. And I have to say, you know, I didn't like the fighting. I stopped going after about maybe 4 or 5 games and between the 2 years. And the reason I stopped going was, first of all, Section 102, I could not walk in that building without being completely harassed. And it was mortifying. I mean, it was, if you were with somebody, or I was with my wife at the time or whatever, and I walked in, I was like, I got to get out of here. This is, they thought it was funny. I just found it embarrassing. And then, you know, I understand fighting is part of the game, but I thought there was too much fighting, not to be, you know, it just was not my thing, you know? But you look at it, it did fill the arena. You take a great organization like the Danbury Titans that followed them a couple teams after. They were a really solid organization with good funding as well. And they were great level hockey. Nobody went compared to what Jimmy did because there was no blood on the ice. There was no fighting. So unfortunately, it's you know, it's like negative campaigning in politics. Everybody says they hate it, but they always read those flyers, right? So, you know, that was a little bit of an issue. So am I resentful that we weren't able to continue that on and build on that success? I think a little bit, sure. I mean, I thought they had a kernel, of a great idea. Maybe not so much fighting. Maybe we scale it back a little bit, but obviously that's a rough league and that is one step below the NHL. So I get it.
I mean, you look at like the Yard Goats, what the Yard Goats have done and how they've become like the darling of, I mean, media. It's like, I don't know if the reporters get passes all the times, but I can't go on Twitter without seeing something about the Yard Goats. And it was like, oh, well, that seemed like that was the potential in Danbury. How about Mayor? I was looking back and you were, I mean, you know, I started at the News Times in 2003. I was at a weekly paper before that. In my mind, you had been mayor since like 1971, as far as I knew. I had no institutional knowledge. You know, I was just trying to keep Paul Sussman from screaming at me, you know, but you had only taken office in 2002. You were like a brand new mayor and you got this guy with his charisma and that was Brian Coons. Thank you, Brian, for coming. But did it create any in those early days in your first couple of administrations there? Did it create any problems politically for you where you have this guy and there's the rumors out there? I know he poured $3 million, $2 million, whatever it was, to get the arena up to snuff that had been like sitting, I guess, vacant for a while or didn't have whatever. Was there anything rough waters in terms of Galante and your beginning of your political career?
Generally, no. I mean, see, Jimmy, you know, Danbury is a city, but it's like a small town. Everybody knows each other, even though it's a city, right? So people knew or had heard the rumors like I had. But there's just a couple little quick things I just want to sneak in here, Eugene. One is, and the Hartford Current got this wrong, and I'm not going to say who, and I did correct it after, but the Current thought that the city owned the arena. We did not own the arena when Jimmy did those renovations. In fact, the permits were applied for by Eagle Eye Sports. That's the company that owned the arena that was owned by somebody who lived in New Jersey. So we had nothing to do with that, you know? So there's no way I could go influence permits or anything like that. We had nothing to do with that. We didn't own it. And there was a perception early on in the investigation that the city owned the rink and somehow the Trashers got a special deal to be in the rink. And that's just not true. The second thing is that in the documentary, and those two young guys do great documentaries. If you have not seen Wild Wild West, put it on your list. It's fantastic. It's
outstanding, yeah.
It's outstanding. And they also did The Battering Bastards of Baseball, which is really
Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Not the independent team.
They're good guys. But they had, I caught it towards the end. They said that you know, Kevin O'Connor, who's a good friend of mine, was a U.S. attorney, said when you throw out a net and it goes against the ocean floor, you catch a lot of stuff. And they said, you know, like we caught the Waterbury. And Joe Santapicha was not the mayor of Waterbury. He was the former mayor of Waterbury. He was elected in 89 and indicted in 90 or 91. And he had been out of office for, you know, 10, 15 years or whatever. So that wasn't quite accurate either. But, again, those two things I thought, outside of that, I thought, you know, it was very well done. But look,
that wasn't our paper, though. That wasn't.
That's right.
For the record, that wasn't me, Paul. That was the
last thing I'm going to say, Karen, unless asked by Eugene. The coverage from the local paper, the News Times became the go-to paper about what the hell is going on in this investigation. Why? Because you guys were boots on the ground. You were there every day. You knew all the players. You knew who to call. And then you also had your contacts both with the federal officials and with the prosecutor's office.
And we were also accurate. I like to pride ourselves on that.
That's why you're accurate. Because
we double check, you know, like good reporters do.
That's one thing, you know, I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, Karen or Paul, but I specifically remember the News Times never saying like Jimmy Galante mobster, right. Jimmy Galante mafia. And I remember because I was the online guy in 2006 and I had to put all the audio, the wiretaps from the FBI on our website, which is that's a whole other there's a documentary. The News Times website in those days. But like, he was associated. He paid a mob tax to the actual mobsters. But I remember and that was Paul and you guys were very careful.
It was annoying. Because we had to say like alleged mob ties.
It was kind of,
it doesn't sound as good and it's like awkward, but we were always, it wasn't as flashy.
Different era of journalism, I think, in that, you know, we just didn't do hot takes. We didn't sort of say what was on our mind. We didn't feel it was our job. And I know Karen feels very strongly about this because we used to talk about it, to really analyze. It was our job to report what was going on and we had no specific evidence that we had in front of us that he was an organized crime figure. It was easy to deduce along those lines that he might be, but that's a way different standard. And at least that era, the era that Karen and I came up in journalism, of putting it in print in a newspaper. Now you could pursue stories suspecting he is and seeing if that panned out, but it was just a different era. And I think the one thing that I almost sort of took issue with the documentary is in retrospective, well, everyone should have known this. Well, in retrospective, it's easy to know this once the feds indict him and there's all this paperwork to be seen. But Karen and I don't have access to wiretaps. You know, we don't have hundreds of FBI agents whispering in our ear. So we, you know, we're covering it in real time and covering Galante in real time. And he's a man, as Mark just said, he's a man of many layers, of many dimensions, you know? He's donating money for new football fields for New Fairfield and hospital wings and stuff like that. And you just come off as sort of sore losers or downers in the community, as buzz killers, if you're going to always crap on people who you suspect might not be the best people at heart, but still do good things for the community. So you have to be careful, I think, when you're covering the community. Karen, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Was blown away, and I'll throw it back to Karen. I apologize too, but I was blown away. There's one part of the documentary where one of the team people is like, well, you know, he was Italian and he was in the trash business. So what do you think? I was like, what? How can you just, I can't believe how you could just say that. But Karen, so you were involved in like the court stuff. I mean, you were the court reporter for the News Times. And you were involved in the very first, I mean, it was Fred Lucas who had covered like the raid, and then you were covering the court stuff. And I know you were well connected and well sourced on the local level with courts and attorneys. But when the feds get involved, my impression, because I have no sources at either level, really, the feds are a whole different ball of wax, right? They're much more impenetrable to kind of say, hey, here's what's going on. Was that challenging for you as to trying to chip away at what was going on here?
Yeah, that's a really good point. They are hard. They were harder to source, and they didn't say as much. But different, I mean, I don't want to say who, but there were different people that did talk. and that were helpful. Yeah, I don't want to out anyone, but you know how journalism is, good reporting and just being a pain in the neck, and eventually someone does talk. And you get, you don't maybe get stuff on the record, but maybe you get stuff that you can, you know, that takes you somewhere. So we did have some good sources, but yeah, of course it's harder, right?
Go ahead.
What Paul was saying was really interesting. What was something that I've considered a lot too, about the layers of Galante, because I know you were saying he's an enigma, and one of the things that struck me during the documentary was just how it showed how close he was with his family, and like a family guy. All those videos of him with his kids. I mean, you don't always see that with families.
Karen, I thought that was a takeaway. The relationship between AJ and Jim. I never saw them like that, you know, growing up. You know, it was fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I had that sense when I was covering him too, that he was very loyal to his family. I have a funny Harple story. Do you guys want to? I think Harple would want me to talk about it. It's not funny, but
Dave Harple, he was a former News Times photographer forever and passed away.
Yeah, great guy. Great photographer, great guy. And I remember I was writing, it was the point where I was writing a personal profile on Galante, and he wouldn't call me back. He wouldn't email, or nobody at his company, even I think Dunleavy, who used to work for the News Times, who went over to work for Jimmy, wouldn't email us back. And you know, when you write a profile on someone, you obviously would like at least a comment. You at least want to let them know what's coming, you know, but nothing for like a couple of weeks. So then one day in the newsroom, I was like, I'm going to just go to his house in New Fairfield. He's got this, I don't know if he still has it. I don't think he does, but he had this gorgeous house in New Fairfield. So Harple just happened to walk by. I'm like, Harple, do you want to come with me? Because I didn't want to go alone. So Harple and I went, and we're thinking, you know, he's going to not answer or just kick us out. Scream. But to be honest, he never screamed at me. He was never rude. And when we got there, he let us in. We talked to him for like an hour. Like, I know you said you had a conversation with him, Eugene. We talked to him for an hour. I don't really remember too much. And he was with I don't know who, but it was an associate, business associate, probably maybe one of his legal team. It was pre-trial, like a pre-trial thing. He was out. He hadn't gotten sentenced yet. He talked to us, but one thing I still remember was, and this was a long time ago, but I remember that after an hour, somebody from his family came home, and I don't know who it was, but he told us to go out the other door. Like, he was being very protective. He didn't want us to run into them. It just seemed like he was. And a couple other things happened where I don't want to say who, but like relatives of his called me angry. I just got the sense that there was love and loyalty, at least to the family.
Within the family, yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's in the beginning of the documentary, one of the first, it's like in literally the first scene where you get one of the guys, I think it was T-Bone, that guy, whoever, the equipment manager, kind of says, well, he was like Darth Vader. And you know, then you have the two twins being like, oh, this is the meanest guy ever. And then the T-Bone's like, and I'm a good judge of character. I really liked him. And I'm like, what? Because the one time I talked to him, he didn't come across as angry or intimidating. He was definitely, I don't remember what I was trying to get information out of him, which was totally, totally useless. And he was having fun. But he reminded me, I don't mean to disparage the guy, but I had worked for a guy in New York at a video store, right, when I was in college. And the guy embezzled $365 million from Philip Morris Tobacco. He was a con man. I mean, and he had the same person. It was very similar personality to what I experienced with that 1 hour with Galante. He was just sort of huffing and puffing, I thought, to some extent. But now, Paul, you were obviously the editor. You were the ones that at the very beginning when all this, and I'm talking about the, you know, when the case broke, when they raided White Street.
What I remember the least about, but go ahead.
Well, no. Well, let's talk about, because when we were off mic for a second there, you were talking about previous encounters you had with Jimmy, which I thought was really interesting, that you and even Karen might have had as well. Something, a football field that he had financed up in New Fairfield.
Well, the bottom line is I came to Danbury in 1999, and Jimmy Galante, in a place without, and this was before Mark was mayor, so I can say that, without a lot of celebrities, he sort of qualified as one of the sort of well-known people in the area, sort of a personality that everyone knew. So he was sort of a buzz in my ear as the, you know, managing editor for the first couple of years. And the first thing I can remember that came to light was that he wanted to donate a new football field to New Fairfield High School with this fancy artificial turf that now everybody pretty much has, but you know, so you don't have to maintain it. But his quid pro quo was that the girls couldn't use it for soccer or field hockey or any of the sports that he considered less than tough and masculine. And we started to write stories with that. And Karen, I thought you had written one of the stories because it had Title IX stuff and you knew someone who did some Title IX expertise.
Lawyer, yeah.
You wrote several stories how you couldn't do this. You couldn't have a high school sports facility and say it's only for guys and not for women. And this went on for a little bit. We wrote a bunch of stories. And one day I got a phone call. I get, you know, a million phone calls of managing editors. Every politician and school principal and congressman and whatever wants to complain about coverage. And someone says, probably a secretary, you know, Mr. Galante wants to talk to you, puts him on. And we had this conversation. And as I told Eugene, I never felt for a second like he was threatening me or was going to, you know, wanted to break my wrist if I didn't stop the coverage. He was trying to explain what he was trying to do. And if there was a legal problem, well, we'd get it sorted out. But, you know, he kept saying, I want to do something right for the kids. And my perception is he, from his inner perception of himself, thought he was misunderstood. He thinks everybody misunderstands him, from the media to the FBI. He's just a misunderstood guy, and he's usually out to do the right thing. That was my perception of him. Later, we had, and Karen, I didn't remember if you were part of this troop or not, he invited us out to AWD, Paul Steinmetz, who was my boss, the editor, Mary Conley, and I thought another reporter, but it could have been Jason, the sports editor, too. And we were having this conversation, and it got a little bit more testy because Mary Conley, the editorial writer, liked to bait him, as she does everybody.
Right.
And he says at one point, well, Mary, you write about me like Tony Soprano. And her response was, well, I wouldn't do it except you keep acting like him. So that was my two big encounters with him. But I just got the impression that he was a guy who thought, in many circumstances, ranging from giving a hockey team to his kid, who loved hockey but had been injured as a player and was never going to be a player, ranging from that to the high school thing in New Fairfield to didn't he give a hospital wing or something?
Yeah, the hospital, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I think he was trying to do the right thing, and no one really understood him because he had this gruff and unpolished demeanor. That was my impression of him.
And Mayor Bowden, I mean, you're born, raised Danbury. I mean, you're as Danbury as Danbury gets. So here is this documentary now comes out about a trash hauler with mob connections who does time, indicted and convicted as part of a RICO case. Is it a blip in Danbury? Is it good, bad? I don't mean to keep concentrating on the negative here, but I'm fascinated. What's been the reaction in Danbury? I guess I'll ask you.
Well, people are fascinated by it. Everybody's either has watched it, will watch it, or is tuning in to watch it tonight. I think that when you can get Drake to put on your uniform and go perform at a show or go to a club, people would say it's a positive. I've got sort of this theory, and I'm just getting crazy when I get older, but wouldn't this just be the most amazing setup to relaunch a hockey team back right in the same facility? Maybe not as rough and tumble, but think about it, right? He'd be sold out for the first like 30 games right after this documentary. So, but then again, I don't know if I could ever see them doing this kind of thing again. It's such a big undertaking. So I will say that in general, the feedback that I've gotten is, aside from everybody screenshotting my little cameo role in there, people have said that not many people sort of got the Section 102 thing, but they sort of were mentioning to me how that didn't really reflect well on Danbury. I'm like, look, first of all, most of those people were from out of town. And secondly, Jim has many facets to him, and he did an incredible amount of good, but he also had this other side to him that, was challenging. If you look at his system, and I don't know if Karen was going to get into this or we have enough time, but the vision he had for disposal of waste, the vision with the actual vision, where he would pick up your trash, process your trash at his transfer station, use a baler to make it like a hay bale, put it on a train, on the train car that he owns, on the tracks that he owns, and send it to a landfill that he owns, was ingenious. It's the definition of a vertical monopoly. He controls every aspect of it, and he probably could have saved their folks about $25 a ton on their tipping fee, which is translates into lower fees for our residents. So that would have been great. But the problem was there were all this other stuff going on, right? So you never got to that thing. And now what's the state talking about right now as we sit here? Sending our trash to landfills. Like somebody was there 15 years ago and you all were upset at him because he wanted to do that. So I guess what I'm saying is, just like Paul said, very challenging person to understand and to know. And I heard the stories too, Eugene. He had nicknames for me. People would come back and say, he calls you the little mayor or little Caesar or whatever. And I used to joke about it and laugh about it. But was I ever intimidated by him? Absolutely not. Was he ever hostile with me? Absolutely not. And I think, he knew not to get hostile with a politician. That would be a bad look for him.
After watching I'm sorry to interrupt, Mayor.
That's okay.
I just can't help myself. But after watching the documentary, I was like, oh God, I'm going to have people on here and I'm going to say, Jimmy Galante was a cheat. Actually, thankfully, Brian Kuhn said it first. Yeah. But that was my impression of him. It's just like sort of a con man and a cheat. And now, but after watching the documentary, I'm like, oh wait, now someone's going to come to my house and slash my tires, because the documentary sort of makes him seem a little dangerous, which people are very much responding to. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know where I'm going with this, but usually a documentary, there's a redemptive arc to it. It tells this story, and at the end, some of the person learns a lesson of some kind, or there's some bigger moral message for society. That's completely absent in this documentary.
Well, either Mark or Brian said it, though. The arc is AJ's, not Jimmy's.
Yes.
True.
It's really AJ's story more than Jimmy Galani's story, because the interview with Jimmy Galani is very unrevealing in the documentary. Probably less than you guys ever got out of him.
I think exactly the same. I had more Mary Connolly, I send her flowers references, which was kind of humorous.
Right, exactly. You almost felt there was a lawyer standing about 5 feet off screen during the filming talking about what was going on. I thought the whole thing was more I almost thought the legal stuff got in the way. As a sports fan, I thought almost got the legal stuff got in the way of a really good story about this renegade hockey team.
Paul, you're right, and it was funny because in my interview, the I call them kids because they're young, they're mid 20s. They asked me, "Can you explain in layman's terms what did Jim do or what did he allege to have done?" And the best way I could phrase it is, look, the public has the right to a fair, free, open marketplace. They have a right to that, right? And when you corner the market and you don't provide that opportunity, you have eliminated that right for people out there. That's what he did wrong. And they're like, well, isn't that an antitrust issue then more than a criminal act? I said, well, if it's alleged that you're using some kind of intimidation, right, to enforce that monopoly, then it's a different story. It could be criminal. So it is fascinating, but the arc is AJ's. I think AJ grew into the job, as Brian said. He had more money to play with than other people did, but he did put together a very exciting team. And I've talked to AJ many times now that he's an adult, and he has learned. He is a gentleman. Every email he's ever sent me has always been very respectful. And I think his takeaway from this was that, you got to do things straight up.
Yeah, that's
for any sports fans who are listening or watching, the sort of thing you didn't get in the documentary is not all their players were bruising fighters. They're not all, aspiring pugilists. If you go back, and I didn't memorize this, but I went back and looked at their statistics, they had a lot of guys who scored 20 and 30 goals, which is a lot of goals in hockey over those years. So the guys they focused on the documentary were the brawlers, but they weren't the guys who helped them win games. In fact, if you look at the statistics, a lot of those guys, they didn't even let play in the playoff games because they knew it was a different animal. You needed to win a playoff game with skill and not all this fighting. So like anything, that documentary had a narrative, and the narrative was it was just the fighting that won. But the cheating, the breaching of the salary cap that let them hire all these top players also let them hire a lot of skilled players too for that level. And that's really what made them good more than fighting. That team would have won with the skill level he put together without all the fighting. The fighting is what put the 2,500 butts in the stands each night and got the national publicity, but that's not why they won games.
Yeah, Eugene, I was at that first game. I was there, actually, with Wayne Shepherd. He was still the publisher of the paper, right? Everybody from being,
I'm near his boyhood home. I'm about 10 houses away.
Yeah, give me a pizza over in Roseland when you get a second. But anyways, I was there, and I don't remember that opening fight. And that's something I would have noticed. There was a game later on in the year where they fought before they dropped the puck. That I remember because I had heard about it at City Hall the next day. But I don't remember them having a fight right before they dropped the puck. And I don't know. If they say it's so, it must be so. But I mean, I was there. It didn't stand out to me if that's what happened. And I think there was sort of a conglomeration of different events that they tried to put together to tell the narrative.
There was a little dramatic license, like with the Sopranos thing, I feel. So I'm just not 100% sure that it's 100% accurate. Like, I just take it with a grain.
Right. Yeah. I remember the opening night was a big deal at the paper. I remember that, Paul Sussman. That was a lot of,
Harpo shot the photo. We had a huge front page photo right before the opening faceoff. All the players on the ice, except the goalies, you can see them. The referee's about to drop the puck. Great shot, sky view. And it says something like our headline was Danbury officially becomes a pro hockey town.
No. I remember the headline. It said game on.
Game on, okay. Game on. So I think
maybe that was the subhead.
Thing that would have happened was it been a brawl, we would have had that photo too.
Yes,
of course. It didn't.
I think the whole listen. There were some epic brawls, and I do remember that, and it became an issue with that team. And I think the sports guys did a great job covering it. But again, that team didn't win because it brawled better than the other team. It won because it could afford to overpay all these minor league hockey players who are still skilled enough to put the puck in the net. That's how you win hockey games. You don't win by fighting better than the other guy. You just don't. And I think that was lost in the whole thing. The other point I wanted to make about the Section 102, and Mark brought that up, they were out-of-towners. One of the contexts is the Trashers came along at a perfect time for pro hockey in Connecticut. The Whalers had been a favorite in Connecticut and had been ripped away from us in the mid to late 90s. New Haven had a minor league team called the Nighthawks for years and years, from the 20s up into the late 90s, and then had turned to an independent team called the Knights in the early 2000s. They had closed. All these hockey fans in Connecticut were desperate for an outlook, especially the minor league fans from the New Haven area who loved the Nighthawks. That team was adored in New Haven over the years. They would pack the Coliseum, which is four times bigger than the Danbury Ice Arena. And those are the people, at least from my personal viewpoint, the games I went to, and my son loved hockey and we went to games, but who had a lot of those fans from Section 102 showed up in New Haven Nighthawks, New Haven Knights, Whalers outfits. They were desperate hockey fans from out of state, and this was their outlet, just like WWE fans have their outlet when they show up and yell at the heel at the WWE matches.
So you sent me.
And this is, you know, to Mark's credit, in his town, I don't think those were Danbury people, most of them.
You did send me, Paul, you sent me to do a feature story on Section 102 specifically. And yeah, the people that, it was hard to get somebody local. They weren't even, it wasn't even like they were from the town surrounding Danbury. I remember that because we were, you know, of course, I wanted to get somebody from Danbury or at least our coverage area. And yeah, they were, I mean, they were definitely, they loved the way they were treated. That's one thing, I guess, that AJ and the crew that ran the Trashers did really well. Like they, those people were loyal. I mean, they still are to this day. You see some stuff on Facebook where it's, some of the people are still talking about this. So they made them seem really welcome. They're also really drunk. I mean, they were drunk walking in there, which is, yeah, you know, it's, I fit right in. But yeah, that was an interesting crew. All right, so let's do final thoughts. So I don't blab on for the rest of the night. Does anybody have any final, maybe things that we're not touching upon about the documentary or the history of Galante and Jimmy Galante and AJ Galante and the Trashers and the history of the News Times? I kind of remember, I just went one thing randomly. It was interesting to work in the News Times in those years because, I mean, it's a very stable paper from what I hear now. You know, they're doing a great job day in and day out. But it was like a sea change to be there from like 2003 to about 2009. And the Galante coverage, Trasher coverage, was like two waves. You know, this is sort of the first wave. But then my former colleague at the Valley Indy, Ethan Fry, they had done another story in like 2018 recapping all this. So like the News Times got a double bang for its buck. And I just want to shout out, I saw Wendy Carlson in the documentary, Brian Coons made in the documentary, Rich Gregory, the former sports reporter, is there in the documentary, the late Mike Duffy, I could tell by his legs and the way he was standing, he's wearing sneakers, were all in the documentary, all former colleagues at the News Times. Mayor Bouton, you were saying something.
No, I just wanted to ask Karen, what is, from, you know, you covering all the court stuff, what is your one takeaway or your one thing that you'll never forget?
From this case?
Yeah.
Oh gosh. There were a couple things that were kind of personal that would hurt like somewhat people in his family. So I don't want to bring it up actually. Yeah. I feel kind of bad.
No, I get you. I got it.
But yeah, I guess the big thing was just the different layers and the fact that there was like this different side to him that people didn't
Karen, see. Was there ever really a day in court? I mean, this whole thing was, you know, these raids and sort of quiet and then a negotiated deal, right? There wasn't really ever a big court proceeding, was there?
Yeah, no, right. Right,
it was contained. It was all contained between the press releases and the court filings.
There were a lot of like court appearances where we'd go and he'd be there talking to his lawyer and ignore us and, you know, or maybe talk to us if we tried really hard to talk to him, but never really saying much. One thing that was interesting was just, it was such a big case. Like there were a lot of co-defendants. It was like the biggest.
40 something, right?
It was, and then every time someone would plead guilty, I mean, you guys in the Eugene and Paul know, then I'd have to do another graphic box. You know what I mean? Because we've done a graphic.
It was torture.
What?
Don't remember Joe, our graphics guy?
Yes, Joe Myers. So, right, we'd have to like, okay, so I love it when it got shorter because then I didn't have to write all these names and double check the spellings and, you know. But there were a lot of co-defendants that pleaded guilty and some got jail time, some didn't. And then I believe he was, you know, I forget if he was actually the last, but he was definitely close to the last.
They gave him a perp walk. I remember that because there's that picture of him that's everywhere in like the brown t-shirt and everything like that. The government sort of, that was a little, looking back, they were definitely, and they kind of say in the documentary, they were going to get him.
Yeah, they were going to get him and they were working on this since the 90s. Yeah.
I remember I remember the day of the raids. I'll never forget that because I was out of town. I was in Hartford. I think I was meeting with the governor about something. And my phone was blowing up, although we didn't have smartphones, we had cell phones. And I was getting all these calls from people about, you know, guys walking around with FBI jackets, DEA jackets, you know, all that sort of official government gear with guns and everything. And remember, this is only what, a couple of years after 9/11. So you don't know what's happening. And I'm like, well, what the heck is going on? So I hop in my car, finish up, and I race down 84 and I get to City Hall and I walk into my office and my phone is ringing and I pick it up and hello. And it's the chief with an FBI agent on the line saying, you know, Mayor, we just want to let you know we're executing warrants at, and he gave me probably 15 addresses. You know, it would be like 122 Smith Street and 307 Jones Street and whatever. And I'm going, oh, okay, well, what's this, you know, what's this in reference to? What, you know, is there an issue? Well, we want you to know there's no, you know, possibility of the community being harmed. There's nothing, you know, it's nothing to do with terrorism or anything like that. But this is an extensive ongoing, investigation. And we're executing all these warrants. I said, okay, well, I appreciate the call, whatever that. But I mean, he when he read off the list of addresses, it probably went on for 20 minutes.
Wow.
It's like, what the heck is going on? But then, you know, it sort of all came out over the next couple of days.
Yeah, that's incredible. All right, everybody. Mr. Sussman, last word?
My last word is the whole thing reminded me of one giant cartoon. And I think the whole cartoon was influenced by another Connecticut organization, the WWE. And we've already made, maybe this is bringing this full circle, but sort of wrapping all the way about, it seemed like this goofball thing at the time from the WWE. And underneath this goofball stuff was this obviously much more serious thing going on. But the layer at the time, the top layer, was fun and funny and entertaining and probably not entertaining. Every guy on the other team got his face bashed in, but there was an okay entertainment value to it too that I think you can separate from the wrongdoing that Jimmy Galante did in terms of the law and terms of competitors and stuff like that. The trashers were fun. There was harmless fun. That's sort of the way minor league sports operated at the time and still do now, but back then was even a little more cheesier. And as far as the documentary, I think, as Karen said, they took some liberties. I think there's a famous quote from a movie that says something like, when the facts are, you know, contradict the legend, print the legend.
Yeah.
And I think the documentary prints the legend. Here's to the facts.
That's true.
That's very well said. All right, everybody. I want to thank Paul Sussman, Mayor Mark Bouton, Karen Ali, and then previously Brian Coons for coming on here tonight. This was really a joy for me. I hope people get a kick out of it. And I want to thank you all for doing this. That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Eugene.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Take care, good everybody. To see you all again.